Okay, good morning. So I'd like to talk about two pieces of work to do with codon usage, which came out recently. And I thought I'd start by telling you the answer, just in case we never get to the answer. So we know that if we look at families of synonymous codons in more or less any genome, then they're not used with equal frequency. So the basic question that people have been asking for a long time is this because of mutation or selection? So obviously, if we have two codons and the relative rate of mutation backwards and forwards between those two is not equal, then the frequencies of the codons won't be equal, right? Or it could be to do with selection. We know it can't be selection on the amino acid sequence because it's the same amino acid sequence whichever synonymous codons you use, but it could be selection on translation. And so so in the first part I want to talk about bacteria. And in bacteria we can compare high and low expression genes in the same organism, and if we see that codon usage in the high and low expression genes is different, then we can conclude that it must be because of selection, because we presume that the mutation is the same in the different sets of genes. And when we do that, we end up finding that the significant translational selection in most bacteria, so for most bacteria, high expression genes have different codon usage than the other genes, okay? And the strength of that effect varies with the growth rate. So the faster the bacteria multiply, the stronger the codon bias. And also, the faster they multiply, the more tRNAs we see in the genome. So the argument is going to be that fast multiplying bacteria require to synthesize their proteins rapidly, and therefore by having extra tRNA genes it means they can transcribe tRNA molecules faster, so the concentration of the molecules goes up and the translation rate goes up, and also they can speed up translation by having biased codon usage.
How many different species did you use?
We looked at 80 bacteria.
80?
Yeah.
So that's an estimated growth rate.
Yeah. So this is just the conclusion. We're going to get to the actual numbers, hopefully. I told you I'd better start with the conclusions. So, okay, so then the interesting thing from the theory point of view is that there's a co-evolution of tRNAs and codon usage. So that means that there's going to be multiple stable states of tRNAs and codon usage, which can be biased in different directions in the same organism at the same time, okay? So one thing I wanted to explain was the observation that in one organism, it's not always the same codon that's preferred, right? Different amino acids have different preferred codons. So that means there's multiple stable states. Okay, so that's kind of part one, and the bottom line there is that translational selection is important in bacteria. Now, then I want to ask the same question in mitochondrial genomes, and it's not the same answer. And the message I want to say in the mitochondrial genomes is that the mutation is a very strong effect. Mutation is varies between species, and it's sufficient to affect non-synonymous substitutions as well as synonymous ones. So it's sufficient to drive frequencies of amino acids to follow the mutation pressure, for example. So that gives us that already tells us that mutation is a big effect in mitochondrial genomes. Mutation turns out to be context dependent. That means that it's dependent on bases either side of the one you're looking at. So it's not a single base effect. It's at least a dinucleotide effect, and that obviously causes biases in codon usage. And it depends on strands. So the two strands of a mitochondrial genome are not the same in terms of their mutational process. And it also depends where you are on the strand. So all these things are they're complicated effects of mutation in mitochondrial genomes. And what I'm going to conclude is that those dominate any translational selection. We can't really see translational selection on top of all these complicated mutational effects.
Is the average rate of mutation of mitochondria higher than in bacteria, or same?
It's higher, I think. Yes. Okay. I never put them on the same scale, but the point is that we can see all these very strong mutational effects in mitochondria. Anyway, let's get to that. Okay, so I think you all know how tRNAs work, right? So we have a tRNA which has an anticodon at one end, which is going to pair with a codon in the messenger RNA, and that's a cartoon of translation. So in the translation process, we have a messenger RNA. It's going to be read in units of codons, which are groups of three, and this cartoon of the fork is the tRNA with its anticodon pairing with the codon, right? So I think we all know that, right, in this. So now we have the standard genetic code, and I've color-coded it so that orange amino acids are amino acids with two codons which end in U and C, of which there are several, like phenylalanine, tyrosine, and so on. Blue amino acids are pairs of two codons which end in A and G, okay? And then the green boxes are four codon families. And the pink ones are special cases, so isoleucine has three codons, and in fact we need a special tRNA to interact with this AUA and to distinguish the AUA from the AUG in the thionine. And arginine is another special case because it has different tRNAs to all the other four codon boxes. But so what I'm going to be talking about mostly is the orange and the blue. So orange means U and C families, and blue means A and G, okay? So how many different tRNAs do we need to translate 64 codons? We need less than 64 because one tRNA can pair with more than one codon. So in the orange families, we only need one tRNA, in fact, and the tRNA always has a wobble position G. So this first position of the anticodon is called the wobble position, and it pairs with the third position of the codon, and this G can pair with either a C or a U at the wobble position there, right? Whereas the other two anticodon positions are always Watson-Crick pairs. So the first two positions here pair with Watson-Crick pairing with the second and third anticodon positions, but wobble pairing occurs at this point here, and this is the key thing. And I will represent that like this by saying there's a wobble G that can pair with either a U or a C. And later on I'm going to think about rates of translation of codons, and these Bs are going to be relative rates, so a BGU is going to be a relative rate of translation of the relative rate by which a G tRNA binds to a U codon, for example.
What do you mean by rate?
Well, we're going to suppose that there's some translation rate for each codon, and it depends on what the codon is and what the anticodon is.
Rate in terms of osmology.
A rate at which that ribosome moves by that codon and deals with that codon.
Okay.
Yeah.
So can we already assume that the GU rate is going to be less than the GC rate, or is it more complicated?
Well, it is. Yeah, I am going to assume that and show that it does appear to be true because, okay, so what's going to happen in this case is that if the GU rate is slower than the GC rate, then this one is going to be the preferred codon. And I'm going to show that in almost every case of an orange amino acid, this is indeed the preferred codon. So that explanation makes sense.
But it could also be that it's just more accurate, right? Not fast.
So we'll worry a bit about accuracy later on, right? So we need one tRNA for an orange amino acid. And now for a blue amino acid here, we always need at least one, and we need at least one which has a U at the wobble position. So a U at the wobble position can pair with either the A or the G, but also, sometimes in these amino acids, we have a C at the wobble position, and the C, we presume, only pairs with the G, okay? So now, this is going to be a bit more interesting because depending on the relative numbers of these U and C tRNAs and the relative rates of these rate constants here, we could get either one or other of those codons to be preferred. Let's just think about what do we need in a four codon family. Well, in a four codon family, sometimes you can, in rare cases, you can get away with just one, which has a wobble U, and that pairs with all four. So that would be the typical situation in mitochondria and a rare situation in bacteria. Usually in bacteria, we have at least two. We have at least a U and a G. And occasionally in bacteria, we have a C as well, okay? So four codon families get a bit complicated because each tRNA pairs with more than one codon, and each codon pairs with more than one tRNA, okay? And then why is arginine special? It's because this situation applies for all those green box amino acids, right? Glycine and all the other green boxes. And so the point is there's never a tRNA gene with an anticodon A in the wobble position in all those other green amino acids. Whereas in arginine, there is. And what happens in arginine is there's a tRNA with an A at the wobble position and one with a C. And that A at the wobble position gets modified to an inosine, so that's this thing here. This is a modified base in the tRNA molecule, which is derived from an A in the gene sequence. And we presume that that can pair, well, at least with these three and probably with the G as well, and then the C pairs with the G. Okay? So I'm not actually going to think about that case anymore, but it's just to note that it's different from the other one.
So there are no, in bacteria, there's no example of anticodon with
A. With a wobble A, other than arginine.
Right. Even, right. So because you would imagine maybe the best thing is to just have four for all four possibilities, right?
Yeah. Think that so there is a question of why. The question for all these other ones is, why doesn't one of these kind of tRNAs mutate to an A occasionally?
Right.
And it appears not to do so, because basically those genes don't exist apart from arginine. So there is an interesting question of, would there be some selection against a tRNA with a wobble A? But anyway, I'm not going to answer that question. So, now how many genes do we actually have in bacteria then? So the yellow ones are bacteria, and so this is the number of copies of tRNA genes, and this is the number of distinct anticodons, okay? So if we look at something with a small genome, then almost all the tRNAs are distinct. So there's 29 distinct ones, there's just two that have been duplicated, right? If we look at the largest bacteria here, the number of different anticodons is not really any larger than the smallest one, but the number of duplicated tRNAs is large, right? So there are multiple copies of most of those tRNAs. And on the right there, we have the minimum doubling time for those bacteria. So this is data collected by Eduardo Rocha, who just basically scanned the literature to find for each species what was the fastest noted doubling time for that species. So it's how fast can it grow under good conditions, which varies enormously between species. So these are very slow growing ones, and these are very fast growing ones. Okay, and the point is that the number of tRNAs increases with the growth rate, right? So the faster it grows, the more tRNAs you have, and that seems to suggest its selection for translational speed. And I just put some other species on for comparison. So mitochondria have far fewer, so they get away with only 22 different anticodons, and you can only do that if you have a single tRNA pairing with a four codon family. So in mitochondria, that 22 arises from the fact that each of four codon family only has one tRNA gene.
You also have higher ribosomal genes, as you go down like this?
Didn't hear you.
Higher number of ribosomal genes?
In these ones?
Yeah.
You have a higher number of ribosomal RNA genes, yes. Maybe it's six or eight in something like this and one in something like that.
It's not that the presence of high number of tRNAs increases the efficiency of ribosomal. It just means that it needs to make more stuff, and so it just makes more tRNA.
The most obvious explanation to me is that if these things are multiplying rapidly, you want to have lots of tRNAs, and the best way to have lots of tRNAs is to have more than one gene so that you can transcribe tRNAs faster. That's
Can you also argue from the ops point of view that the slower growing ones may simply be getting rid of these extra copies of tRNAs to economize genome size? So it's actually selection.
Yeah. Well,
genome size.
These ones are the ones with the smallest genomes are the internal parasite, the endosymbionts and the parasites, right?
Yeah.
And they have small genomes, so they've lost a whole lot of genes. and they've probably evolved from something in the middle. So I'm presuming that ancestral things were somewhere in the middle, and that you've got these have gone downwards, as you said, after they became parasites. But why can you get why can you get away with fewer tRNAs? I'm suggesting
they only shed the tRNAs;
they've shed
everything that
yes.
they don't.
And as a result, they only multiply every 3 days instead of every 30 minutes, right? So I'm suggesting that they don't, they're in some kind of an environment where they're not selected for rapid multiplication and they don't need extra genes in that environment, I guess. Is that
yeah, in theory, if the conditions are constant, every step is rate limiting. So, I mean, you are both right. I mean, tRNA genes are fewer because they are going to be selected to the right limiting step. But everything is going to be rate limiting. And so you will lose other things. I think that's, no?
Yeah. Well, I'm just suggesting that the evolution is not just entirely directional in one way. It goes both ways.
Yeah.
You shed them.
Yeah, so I think the direction in here is that you've lost them, but when would a loss be allowed? So one thing I want to do with the theory is to say, when is it favorable to duplicate a gene? How many genes should we have, basically? So
it is well known that these tRNAs are basically transcribed as fast as they can?
I don't know whether it's not. I mean, there are some complications, like tRNAs sometimes come in operons and there's five in a row, and there's some complications, like it depends on whether you're close to the origin of replication or far from the origin, because the ones near the origin are present in multiple doses if you've half replicated the genome. So there are complications like that that make it more complicated, but I'm basically supposing that for what I'm going to do, that when a tRNA is on, I'm basically going to suppose that a tRNA is on all the time, and that the concentration of tRNAs is proportional to the number of genes. That's what I'm going to suppose. Okay, so now we go back to some old theory with selection, mutation, and drift. So we consider just a two-codon family, and we consider the U and the C at the third position, mutating backwards and forwards. So U is some rate, and theta is a number of order 1, which just determines the relative rate of going from U to C to C to U, okay? And so if there were no selection, then this is the fraction of C codons. The number of Cs that we observe divided by the number of Cs and number of Us, it's equal to theta in absence of selection. Then if we turn on selection, we've said, let's make the C favored for the reason that you just said. We're going to suppose that the C codon is favored by this selection coefficient S. Then the relative fraction of Cs is dependent on both the mutation parameter theta and on big S, where big S is 2 times the population size times little s. Okay. So if I plot so this is the fraction of C codons. If I plot it as a function of selection, it's going to be, when selection is naught, it's going to be equal to theta, and in my diagram, theta is a half, but it needn't necessarily be a half. I turn on selection, and this goes up towards 1. Now, the point is, then, that I can observe codons. I can count these codons, and from just counting the codons, I can estimate the S. So if I reverse this formula, then S is equal to that. And so I need to make two observations. And I'm just going to suppose then that there's a small fraction of highly expressed genes in which selection is much larger than everything else. So I'm just going to suppose that selection on codon usage is very important in highly expressed genes because there are many copies of this thing. Whereas in the rest of the genes, I'm just going to neglect it altogether. So I'm going to say that I'll call it low. So I'm going to suppose that so the small set of highly expressed genes is going to be ribosomal proteins and things to do with translation like elongation factors. And we use a set of 40 highly expressed genes which were the same set identified by Paul Sharp in a paper that I'm going to mention in a minute. And then I'm going to suppose that everything that's not one of those highly expressed genes is a low expression gene. So these are just the counts of the codons in, for one amino acid, one orange amino acid with U and C codons, the counts in the low expression genes. These are the counts in the high expression genes. And from those two observations, I can estimate S. So let's take some examples. Different species here, asparagine, aspartic acid are two of the orange amino acids. Estimate my theta and phi, from that I get my S. And the point is S is a positive number in all those cases. And positive number means that the C codon goes up in the high expression genes. So in that log ratio there, if the C codon increases in frequency in the high expression genes, then S is positive. And S is always positive, right? So that agrees with the what we just said, that the G codon pairs better with the C. And, okay. So now we need, so let's just go one step beyond that and have some rate theory. So let's suppose that there is some tRNA concentration which is proportional to the number of genes. So C naught is the concentration of tRNAs produced by one gene, and NG is the number of tRNAs with a wobble G. So the G signifies that it's a wobble position gene. And now let's suppose that the rate at which a codon is translated by a given type of tRNA is some number k naught times a relative factor which depends on which the anticodon and the codon is. Okay, so this is some factor that this is some rate in real time that we don't know, and this is some factor of order one, which we want to estimate by comparing which codons are favored and not favored. So in the simplest case, I have a rate for translating a U codon and a C codon. I'm going to suppose that the mean time for each codon is 1 over the rate, and that the selection strength is proportional to the difference in the mean times. So I have several constants in this that I don't know. I have a C naught, a K naught, and I have this sigma factor. But those all lump together into one thing called capital K. So my selection strength is some one constant capital K times factors which are of order 1. So NG is the number of tRNA genes, and the Bs are these relative rates. Now, and we know how to estimate S. That was on the previous thing. And I'm going to argue that the thing we really want to estimate is K, because K is a driving force for selection, right? S is the selection strength that we observe, but it depends on the number of genes. And the number of genes is a variable, okay? And the number of genes is going to go up when translational selection is strong. So NG is not a fixed factor when we're comparing species. So we want to calculate this K thing, this K, which is a species-dependent quantity, okay? And K is the S that we calculate from the codon frequencies times the number of genes that we know divided by this factor. Now, we still don't know what this factor is, but in the simplest case, that's just some positive number of order 1. So if I want to compare species, compare the orange amino acids in different species, this is some factor of order 1 that is not very interesting at this stage.
Okay, so I find it a bit complicated. So So the idea here is that to duplicate, you have to double everything you have. And so the time that it takes to double everything you have is sort of inverse fitness, right? This is sort of the assumption that goes in here. But then I would sort of say that, isn't it then sort of like aren't the tails important? Isn't like those genes that, or those proteins take longest to translate are the ones that actually set the fitness of the organism rather? I mean, is there just one gene?
So this is applying to my set of highly transcribed genes. So we know if we just look at the expression level, say in microarrays, they differ by orders of magnitude, right? So you might have 1,000 times more of these highly expressed genes than of the typical genes. Yes. So I'm supposing that a significant fraction of the effort of translation in the cell goes into making large numbers of copies of these small numbers of genes.
Yes.
And that's what is represented by that. So this is the this is the saving I get in making a mutation in a highly expressed gene from one codon to the other, right?
Because are the TUs and TCs parameters that you know, or you want to determine or to guess?
I want to determine them, right? But I want.
But I mean, the translation rate does not only rely on the speed of translation. It also depends on the amount of RNA, which determines the transcription rate and turnover. Bacteria turnover is very fast, so it's much faster than the time of division of the cell. So if you lower, for example, by a factor of two, your turnover rate, then you increase the RNA by a factor of two. So it's going to mess up your calculation a lot.
So the time is not going to be, all I have to do is suppose that the total, when the translation time goes up, the time for duplication of the cell goes up, but it doesn't necessarily have to be proportional. So there's going to be some other, the cell has to do lots of other things as well as translation. But what I have to say is that the translation is a significant effect in these fast multiplying bacteria, so that if I can save time on translation, I also save time on multiplication, right? The thing I want to explain is the codon bias. So the thing which is different has to be to do with, in the simplest case, it's one tRNA interacting with two codons. So whatever the crucial step is, it has to distinguish between one tRNA interacting with two codons. This tRNA has to do a whole lot of other things too. It has to be charged, it has to be synthesized, it has to be charged, it has to be recharged each time it's being used. And then there's all the other steps in the ribosome where the amino acid is taken from the tRNA and put onto the protein, right? All those other things don't really depend on what the codon is, right? So if I'm trying to explain codon bias, I have to really focus in on the step which is different for those two codons, right?
Yeah, relative numbers, absolute numbers, usually.
Relative numbers of what?
What you uncheck is the relative the ratio of TU over TC, not really the actual rates, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So.
Because you are not going to be able to infer the rates of translation of the codon by just.
No, but I can compare. What I can infer, hopefully, is which is faster. Okay.
Yeah, okay, so it's
right. Yes. Yes. So these Bs are relative rates of different codon anticodon combinations, and there are some measurements of those things that we'll get to in a bit.
So I guess you're looking at the case where you're going to change one codon in one amino acid in one of these highly expressed genes, and now you're wondering what is going to be the effect on fitness of this.
Yes.
And you're writing down an S that says it's the difference in the time you take for that one amino acid to translate it.
Yeah.
But I mean, isn't it some relative number to, you know, what is the percentual change in the time it takes to make these?
You can include that in the constant then, can't you? All I'm saying is that the selection is proportional to the difference in the time with some constant that I don't know. Okay.
Somehow in this reasoning there is the assumption that this is the limiting time step, because if it was not, you know, if it's epsilon plus or minus, you know, slightly.
There's an assumption that this makes a difference. I don't know whether it has to be the limiting thing, right? It just happens, it just has to be sufficient to make a difference.
So assuming that doubling the number of tRNAs, it doubles the efficiency with which you transfer.
And I am assuming that, because the time goes like 1 over the number of genes.
Right. So these are the genes that are rate limited by the number of tRNAs, presumably.
Is that the definition of
NG? All I'm assuming is that the more tRNAs you have to wait for a tRNA to come to the ribosome, and you have to wait for the right tRNA to come to the ribosome. So the more tRNAs of one type there are, the faster that codon is going to be.
You're assuming that that's the rate limiting step. Because if you have double the number of ribosomes, then doubling the tRNA helps. But then you have to double the ribosomes at the same time.
Before it's codon, right?
For this codon, yeah.
Okay. So what I was trying to say then is, why do I want to estimate K? I've explained how you estimate S from the data, right? But I want to estimate K, and the reason I want to estimate K is because the S depends on the number of genes, and the number of genes is not fixed when I compare species. So now we're going to estimate K. And this is just estimated from averaging all the orange amino acids. So and there's 80 bacterial genomes. And we chose those because they had been done by Paul Sharp. So the method of estimating S that I just said was in a paper by Paul Sharp in about 2005. And they'd selected a particular set of 80 bacterial genomes that covers the full range of bacteria. So we wanted to use the same data, and we wanted to go beyond that. Because firstly, they only looked at the S, and I'm arguing that K is more important because we want to explain the variation in the number of genes. And we want to explain the A and G codons as well, which is more interesting because selection goes in two directions. So at this stage, what we're concluding then is that those orange amino acids are a good way of estimating the strength of selection, because we know the direction, right? The direction is the C codon is preferred in just about every case we see. So that means we don't have any complications in what the Bs are, as long as that means that B factor is just a constant factor. Okay, the B's on the bottom there. It's a constant positive number, so we don't need to worry about it when we compare species. So what we see then is that the ones with the strongest selection have the fastest doubling time, okay? Which is what we saw in the first table, but that just shows that it applies quite nicely to a large number of species. And we also see that the number of tRNA genes goes up with the strength of selection. So this is the number of tRNA genes, and the triangles are the number of different anticodons. So basically, the number of different anticodons doesn't change much, but the number of gene copies goes up a lot. Okay, so that was the orange case. So let's do a slightly more interesting case. Then the blue case is A and G codons. And so the formula is the same, and I've defined it such that if the G codon is preferred, if the G codon goes up in the high expression genes, then S is positive. And if the G codon goes down, then S is negative. And, well, it's not always the same. So here's a case where, so now it depends on the number of tRNA genes. So the simplest case is there's just one tRNA and it has a wobble U. So 1-0 means there's one copy of the wobble U tRNA and none of these. And you see in the 1-0 case, S is negative. And that means, so negative S means A is preferred by that definition. And A is preferred, presumably, because this U pairs better with an A than a G. So the Watson-Crick pairing of U and A is better than the wobble pairing UG. So when there's only U tRNAs present, the A codon is preferred. So let's look at this data. 1-0, 1-0, that's minus, 1-0 again, 2-0, 2-0, 3-0. They're all minus, right? So when there's only one type of tRNA, so 3-0 means there's three copies of the U tRNA, none of the other ones, right? This is negative again, right? But there are some positive ones, so here's a 1-1, right? So a 1-1 is positive, this 1-1 is positive, and we should see some 1-2s, 1-3s here, these are positive, okay? So let's do the 1-1 case, right? There's one of each of these things, and both of these pair with this, right? So we can say there's twice as many tRNAs that pair with this one than there is with this one, so we might expect that 1-1 case to favor the G, which is what we see. So the direction of the selection is going to depend on those relative rates and on the numbers of the tRNAs. Okay, so now let's just pick the E. coli case. Two different blue amino acids in E. coli. So glutamine happens to have a 2-2 situation, and the G is preferred. And glutamic acid has a 4-0 situation, and the A is preferred. And this is in the same organism at the same time. So this is why this was kind of the thing that got me interested in this in the first place, because it's a case where you've got multiple stable states in the same organism, right? So if we suppose mutation is the same for those two things, the tRNAs are different, so selection acts in different directions, But there must be a coevolution of tRNAs and codon usage such that each is stable with respect to the other. So the codon usage adapts to the current tRNA genes, but the tRNA genes must be stable at the current codon usage, because we can, you know, we can go from a 2-2 situation to a 3-1 just by making a mutation in the anticodon, right? Well, it would be relatively easy to change one tRNA to another by a single anticodon mutation, and if we did that, the selection would be strong, okay? Because the selection on a codon, on a third position of a codon, only affects that one codon. But the select, but if we change the anticodon, it affects every codon for that amino acid. Okay, so the selection on the anticodon should be orders of magnitude stronger than on the codon. So we would expect that if there's any significant selection at all on the codons, there should be very strong selection on the anticodon. So the anticodon should be in there. Most favorable state. So what I'm going to do then is calculate, I want to calculate for a given codon usage what's the most favorable tRNA state, and then I want to show that the tRNAs and the codon usage are stable together, and I want to be able to show that there's more than one stable state in the same organism at the same time. Right? So let's do this case again. This is just the same assumption as before. And now my selection comes out to be this constant, this driving factor, times these numbers of order one. So the n's and nu's and nc's we can observe. And now these b's are more important now, because it does matter what the relative rates of these combinations is. And I'm going to assume this. I'm going to, right, these are relative rates, so I can always define one of them to be 1 by definition. So I'm going to define BUA equals 1, and I'm going to show later on that, what do I need, CG. I'm going to suppose that this equals 1, because I'm going to show that this actually fits the data fairly well, and then BUG is 0.4, right? So this combination fits the data fairly well, but basically we're saying that Watson-Crick things are faster than wobble ones, okay? Okay, so now the point is that if I know what those rates are, I can observe the number of genes, the NUs and NCs, and then I can say that the direction of the selection depends on what the number of genes is. And I'm going to consider this case that I just showed you with 4 genes, like in the E. coli glutamine. So that if there are 4 genes, then the combinations are 4, 0, 3, 1, 2, 2, and 1, 3. And I can't have nil 4 because I have to have, I'm assuming that only the U pairs with the A codon. So I can't have nil copies of the U. Okay?
So what is the evidence for assuming BUA and BCG are similar? Because the binding energies, there is about as much difference between CG and UA as there is between UA and UG, right?
Yes. So I don't have any. The way I'm going to deduce these is by looking at the direction of selection in different organisms. And if I choose wrong values of these Bs, then I'll get it wrong. Okay? So the kind of data that this is the kind of data that we observe. For example, a 1-1 is positive and a 1-0 is negative, and a, you know, by looking at the direction of selection with different combinations, I can get limits on what these Bs must be. And I'm going to leave that till the quite a long time. But this is the numbers that came out. So for the theory that I'm going to show you now, those were the numbers I assumed. Okay, so now we need to, so this is the crux of the theory then now. So okay, so this is, in this diagram I've just picked theta as a half, so in absence of selection it's a half, and then I follow the frequency of the codon as a function of the k, so I'm plotting that, that's the codon frequency as a function of selection, and selection depends on the numbers of genes in this way. So now depending on the number of genes, either selection goes upwards for these two combinations or downwards for these two combinations, okay? So if I tell you what tRNAs I have, then I know which curve I'm on, okay? But now I want to make this self-consistent with respect to mutations in the tRNAs. So the mean time for a codon to be translated is this thing. And this thing is a linear function of the codon frequency, right? This is just a straight line as a function of the codon frequency. So if I plot time per codon as a function of codon frequency, I get a straight line. And either it goes up or down, depending on which is the preferred codon, okay? So in the 4-nil case, A is the preferred codon, and it means that the best thing I could do is to have phi equals 0, which means zero frequency of the G codon and 100% frequency of the A codon, right? So selection always goes in one direction. If selection were dominating, then I would go to one extreme or the other. But selection is not completely dominating, so we're at some mutation selection balance. And that's what this curve tells me, is where am I as a function of mutation selection balance. So let's suppose I'm on the 3-1. Let's suppose my tRNAs are 3-1. And my mutation starts off in the middle, selection is pulling me downhill. Now it depends how strong that selection is. If selection pulls me downhill a little bit, then I'm still, say, I end up here, right? I'm still in this region between these two curves where the 3-1 situation is the favorable situation. So that means I'm stable. And that means I'm on this red part of the curve here. Selection is pulling me down, but it's still within these two limits where the 3-1 situation is the best thing. So therefore, the 3-1 thing is stable. On the other hand, if selection were very strong, I'd move over here. So over here corresponds to selection pulls me down here, but here now it's favorable to make a tRNA mutation. So I make a tRNA mutation, and the 4-0 case is better. Okay. So those red parts of the curves are the regions which are stable combinations of codon usage and tRNA numbers. And they're stable with respect to, in this example, with respect to anticodon mutations, but I've only considered the total number of tRNAs equals 4, right? I'm not allowed duplications yet. Okay? And so the main conclusion then is that if the selection is weak, then there's only one stable combination of tRNAs, and that corresponds to the one which is in the range where the mutation parameter is, the theta parameter, okay? But if I turn on selection, then for some general selection value, there are several different red regions. That means several different stable combinations at the same time. So now I can explain, you know, why glutamine goes one way and glutamic acid goes the other way.
So if you said a 0-4 possibility was very unlikely, or you know, because you needed somebody to bind with the A, so if you say where the straight line here would go in this graph, if you had considered it.
Well, if it outside. It would be infinitely. I mean, if my formula is right, this would be naught. So I'd just get an infinity here. So if my assumption that the C cannot pair with the U is true, then it doesn't make sense, right? And if there were some very small rate of a C pairing with a U, then I'd have a very steep line there, right? Okay. So now we have to think about duplication. So now we can go back to the simplest case where there's only one tRNA. So we're back to the orange amino acids and we look at duplication. And we have to think about a cost function which is more general than just the time per codon. And I'm going to say this big T is a cost function, which is, this is a time per codon, it's the same thing as we had before. And FA is the frequency of that amino acid, right? So the more times that amino acid is used in the protein sequences, the stronger the selection on that kind of codon should be, because we need to do it more often, okay? And then I'm going to suppose there's a cost per gene. So little g is a cost per gene, and this is the number of tRNA genes, right? So why is there a cost per gene? Presumably, it's because tRNAs are on all the time. So I'm going to suppose every gene you have is on, and you're producing many, many tRNA molecules from these genes, and you're spending resources making tRNA molecules. You're also spending, maybe you're spending resources in duplicating the genome. The genome doesn't want to be longer than it needs to be. So for those reasons, there's some cost per gene, and those things have to balance, right? So now we do the same thing as before. We calculate for this is the number of copies of the NG, right? So now for a given number of tRNAs, the codon frequency goes up as a function of the strength of selection. So if I start off down here, the best thing with weak selection, the best thing is to only have one gene. So this is why slow multiplying organisms have few genes. It's because the best thing you can do is minimize your cost per gene, right? But sooner or later, if you turn up selection, it becomes better to duplicate the gene. And then paradoxically, if you duplicate the gene, the strength of selection goes down. So if I duplicate the gene, both codons are translated faster, so the difference between them goes down. So somewhat paradoxically, because selection strength goes up, I duplicate the gene, and then for the observed codon bias goes down a bit. And this happens regularly, okay? So the points at which I duplicate the gene depend on how big the G. So the key thing really is going to be the ratio of the G to the FA, right? The bigger the cost of the gene, the fewer genes there'll be, and the longer it takes before I duplicate. So what you can see if we look at the red stable regions is then that basically the codon bias should increase. If I kind of draw a big thick line through the middle of those red regions, the codon bias is increasing as a function of the selection strength, but it's not increasing as fast as it would if I was at a fixed number of tRNAs, because the tRNA number reduces the strength of the selection. Okay? So now we can, okay, so now this is the basic observation that the number of tRNAs does go up when K goes up. I mean, that's what this curve says. As K goes up, it pays to duplicate tRNAs, and that's exactly what we see.
I'm sort of confused because there was already the first term already had some N gene.
Yes.
So the reason you didn't have the second term before is because it was a constant, essentially.
Yes. So in the case, the first case I looked at, this case, I considered. I suppose there were four tRNAs, because in the example of E. coli, there were four for glutamine and four for glutamic acid, and I wanted to explain why those two went in opposite directions. So in that thing, I've just got four genes, but I'm allowing anticodon mutations, right? And this is, for the AG case, this is an interesting case, because the direction can go in different directions, right? If I looked at a U and C amino acid with fixed numbers of amino acids, it's not interesting because there's only one curve, right? So now the next thing I'm going to do is to say, let's look at the case, the U and C case, where the selection is always in the same direction. It's always in favor of C, but it depends on the number of genes. That's this case. And now, of course, I want to do both. So I want to do, well, I want to do both, right? So I want to consider a blue amino acid where either of the genes can, there's two types of tRNAs and both of them can duplicate, right? See what I mean?
Yeah, no, this is just this formula, so you put it by hand, I understand.
Which are we talking about? This one?
Yeah, there's two terms. So the first term is what we saw previously, and the second term is...
If I cross that out, then the first term is the mean time per codon, right? Right? And in the first example, the second term was a constant, so it didn't matter because I was considering a fixed number of genes, right? So now I want to consider variable numbers of genes, so I want to add that on. And I also want to consider the fact that it depends on which amino acid I'm talking about, because the frequencies of the different amino acids also vary, and I'm just going to suppose then that the time we save depends on how many times the this is the number of times we use a codon for a given amino acid A, right? And this is the mean time for that codon. So it's obviously the amount, the selection should depend on the frequency of the amino acid, right?
I guess but the problem is to see through if the parameters you really introduce are really all the things that are there. right? So somehow the implication is that as the doubling time goes down, right, so if these guys get reproduced faster, K is somehow monotonically increasing. And G is somehow being kept constant as you do this, right? So as you go to...
little g, yeah.
Right, so I also find it hard to sort of see through, are all these things sort of plausible assumptions or not, right?
So we want to say, what is the selective effect for duplicating a tRNA gene? And I'm just assuming it's the same for each time we duplicate. So you could do something complicated, like make it depend on how many genes there are already. You could make G some function of the number of genes there are already, but that just makes more parameters which I don't really want to introduce, right? But, I mean, the simplest thing I can do is assume there is some cost for duplicating a gene, and I want to be able to predict when will a gene duplicate as a function of that cost. Yep. So, okay, so we want to test something. So let's just test the U plus C case. This is the number of genes observed for different amino acids in different bacteria. So the n obs is the number of cases in my data where there was an amino acid with this number of genes. And, well, these are the relative times, and the point is the selection depends on the difference between the times, and the difference is always positive. So then this is just the mean K and the mean S observed for the different cases, and this is the number of cases where the selection goes in the direction that I was expecting it to, and it's almost every case. This number is slightly less than this number, but this is in the case where it's weakest effect anyway. So some of those wrong direction effects are just noise, because we're down in a case where the selection is too small to make any difference, it's just random. There may be some systematic effects that we're missing. So there's a couple of systematic effects that may explain why those cases go the opposite way. And one of them is this strand effect. So if we have a double-stranded genome, then one of them is the leading strand and the other one is the lagging strand. And so mutation may be slightly different on leading and lagging strands. So we know, for example, there's things like GC skew. If you look at GC skew along a genome, it usually depends on where you are relative to the origin of the replication. So now the point is that high expression genes, there's a bias of high expression genes to be on the leading strand. And the leading strand would be the opposite strand on here, right? So one factor that's not in this at the moment is to distinguish between which strand they're on. And if there's some slight skew in the mutation, that's going to potentially mess things up a little bit if the selective strength is small, right? So if the selective strength is strong, then this is a weak thing anyway, and we can just average them. But if we're down in this kind of a region where the selection strength is small, then maybe this kind of a bias is more important than the translational selection.
When you say that there is a localization of highly expressed genes around the origin, well, what's happening is that this depends strictly on the definition of highly expressed genes that you were given, because there are more relaxed definition of it and evidence in terms of experimental results that are telling us that highly expressed genes that might bias, in fact, your genome, are in fact spread out to all genes. So these are aspects concerning the localization of highly expressed genes. It seems to me kind of a strong assumption.
I have not looked at this, but there are various papers that said there's two effects, in fact.
Yeah.
There's the effect of potential localization close to the origin, and there's the effect of bias between strands. Okay.
Between strands, yes.
Between leading and lagging strands,
yeah.
Which is probably the most important thing, because then if the mutation is slightly different on the two strands, then...
Yes, but this affects all genes in the genome. This doesn't affect only this particular kind of highly expressed genes that you consider. that allow you to define S.
Yes, but if the... Okay.
What I'm saying is that you start from an assumption that is very, very strong, and this starts from the sharp assumption in defining the set S. If you relax the definition of highly expressed genes on already starting at the definition of S, those type of considerations are hard to make because, in fact, there is a distribution all over the genome of these highly expressed genes, and we know it experimentally. So what I'm saying is that all this might work, but it's inside a world where we put very, very strong assumption on what we mean to be translationally biased.
Okay, there's different reasons why you can be translationally biased. So I know, I mean, I was reading your papers about selecting what are the most biased genes, and I know you start from the, you want to start from a position where you select what are the most biased genes for, without knowing what the reason is, right? You just want to select biased genes which differ most from the average in some sense, right? But then what you see is different effects in different organisms, right? So sometimes it's to do with translational selection, sometimes it's to do with skew between the strands. You see all sorts of different things, right? Which is fine. But I'm starting from the point of view that I want to detect translational selection, and then I have to assume that these ribosomal proteins are highly expressed in all organisms. Which is an assumption, but it's not a very strong assumption. I would say that's a pretty solid assumption that ribosomal proteins are highly expressed in all organisms.
Yeah, what I believe is that we can go a bit further away from this in the sense that not only ribosomal proteins are the only highly biased genes inside the genome, and this goes in general through all types of microbial organisms at very different scales, okay, in terms of the signals that we can capture. And if we start from putting choosing the notion of translational bias based on translational on ribosomal proteins, the signal that we can actually take out from this analysis is very low. It's too low for discriminating on those organisms that are not so translationally biased. That's what I'm saying. But, okay.
Right, but this tells me how strong is the selection on the ribosomal proteins. That's what I want to measure. So if I'm down in these organisms here, where I'm basically at naught, then I'm saying in those organisms, selection on the ribosomal proteins for translational selection is weak in those organisms, and I'm measuring the fact that in some organisms it's much stronger than others, right? And now I'm saying that there are a small number of cases where my theory doesn't make sense. In this example, it's only a very small number of cases where it goes the wrong way, and it goes the wrong way when I expect the selection to be weakest anyway. And therefore, other things like this are probably more important in those species, right?
But I think there is an issue here that somewhere at the very beginning of your talk, something we went on very fast, which was just to say there is this small subset of genes that are very highly expressed, and they dominate the selective effects. So to disentangle mutational biases from selective biases, we divide genes into two groups. One is these very highly expressed ones, and we assume that they have selection acting on them, and then you have the and you assume they have no selection acting on them, whereas in fact there's probably some continuum.
Yeah.
If this continuum looks very different for different bacteria, this might somehow bias.
I'm going to show you that graph for yeast, where we have groups of genes with different expression levels. But for all these bacterial species, we don't have the expression levels. So we're keeping it as simple as possible, which is to say... So I want to make some easy comparison between many species, right? And the assumption that the ribosomal proteins are higher than everything else is true by orders of magnitude, right? So if I just make the same comparison in many different species, I can compare species, that's the point. But I would like to be able to do it as a function of expression level, and I have a graph in yeast where I do that in just a minute.
Check if the distribution of the amount of codon bias looks sort of bimodal, and I somehow doubt that it's going to come out like that, right? Because that is sort of what you're saying.
No, but you are not taking into account every gene in the genome. You are just taking the extreme more...
I'm assuming that there are very large numbers of genes in the genome that have low expression. and let's just wait until I get to the yeast graph, because this explains
the high express gene. What is the subset of gene you use for low?
I use all the genes. So I am using all the genes, but I'm assuming that there is very large numbers of low expression genes, and so just averaging every gene once is the same as taking the low expression gene. That's what happens. You could be, if you have measurements of expression level, you can be more careful and you can choose, you know, a fraction of the lowest expression genes, right? If you want to. But we don't have that for 80 bacteria. Okay, so now we were talking about what happens when you get duplications as well as anticodon mutations. And, well, this is what comes out. So I'm only plotting the stable regions now. So as we turn up selection, the stable combinations change. And there are some there's a big gap here where there was nothing stable. So for example, there's no 1 to 2. There's a 1 to 1 and a 1 to 3, but the 1 to 2 curve goes through this region, but it's never stable for this combination of parameters. So what parameters affect this? Basically, it's theta. So theta is the mutation parameter, which in this diagram is a half. So if it was 0.6 or 0.4, all these curves would start higher or lower, right? And it also depends on this G over F, which is the relative cost of a gene compared to the frequency of the amino acid. Okay. What are we saying then? We're saying that if I'm at low selection strength, I'm going to be in the simplest case where there's only one gene, right? If I turn up selection, I'm going to tend to duplicate genes, but also I could find myself extremely biased one way or the other when I'm at high selection. And so in different organisms and in different amino acids in the same organism, I could go in different directions. Okay. This is the same thing viewed in a different way. So if I just say, if I keep the strength of selection fixed, and this is at a low selection strength, and vary the mutation bias, then basically, this is almost a straight line, right? So the observed codon frequency is equal to the mutation bias because this selection is weak. So more or less, that's a straight line. Whereas if the selection, now let's do a case where the selection is strong, we vary the mutation bias, and this is always more extreme than the mutation parameter, right? So the mutation parameter is somewhere in the middle, and the observed codon frequency is lower. If the mutation parameter is less than a half, the observed codon frequency is less than that. And if the mutation parameter is high, then the observed codon frequency is higher than that. So, okay. And does it go in the right direction? So now it's more interesting to say, does it go in the right direction? Because when there's only one type, so the 1-nil, 2-nil, 3-nil, there's only one type here, the selection is negative by my definition. And the majority of, so this is the number of observations, this is the number of cases that go in the direction predicted. The majority of cases do, but again, when we're down here, there's quite a lot of noise here, right? If we look at the average, so this is the average S for cases in each category. And the average S is always in the same direction as the predicted direction of selection, right? So here's a positive, so positive ones are down here. So on average, this is agreeing, but now it starts, but this case depends quite a lot on what these numbers are, okay? So this is where we have to get back to what are the relative rates of these different things, because where the thing tips from one direction to the other depends on the relative rates of these things. And hopefully, yes. So that's what we're doing now, is we're trying to say what values of those relative rates best explain the data. So I'm allowed to fix one of them to be 1 by definition. So I'm fixing UA to be 1 by definition. Now I'm going to consider what happens as I vary these two parameters. And the contour plot shows the fraction of cases which are correctly predicted. So I have constraints, right? Each observation is a constraint that selection goes one way or the other. And I just measure, well, what fraction of cases go the way predicted as a proportion of those parameters. And we end up with this most likely region in the middle, which is basically where the CG is about 1 and the EUG is about 0.4. So that's why I got those numbers. Okay, so then we start to get to think about, well, our preferred codons really translated faster, right? That's what I've been saying all morning. And there are some quite old experiments that say that they are. So one good set of experiments is this thing using a frame shift. So they looked at a gene which is prone to make a frame shift at a particular point in the middle. And if the frame shift happens, then I'm going to get a different length protein from if it doesn't happen, right? So you can easily detect what the frequency of the frame shift is, and that depends on what the codon is just at the point before the frame shift occurs. So now, if you have a slow codon at that point, then there'll be more frame shifts because basically you're hanging about waiting for the tRNA in this slow codon and then the frame shift happens, right? Whereas if you have a fast codon at that point, you'll get past it before the frame shift happens. So,
I understand that it is more complicated than that. There are structures and second contexts. Maybe
yes.
That's not, might not be so simple to apply this hypothesis to just transaction rates.
Well, okay, you can take that up with these guys. What they did is they looked at many different messenger RNAs which differ in just one codon at that point where the frame shift occurs.
But are those actually sites which are naturally selected to be frame shifted? Because that,
there's one.
Places where, I mean, there are certain genes in actual viruses or even genomic genes. Which encode two proteins, and so this is a selected mechanism of translation. Then it's more complicated than just saying this is a low frequency.
Yes, but the point is they picked something where they know a frame shift is likely to occur. So they picked, it wasn't just any random gene. They picked some gene where they know that a frame shift occurs reasonably likely at some particular point. So there's something peculiar about that messenger RNA that makes the frame shift occur there.
Yeah, so it's not just the codon usage frequency, I mean, of course. Otherwise, I mean, maybe there is a low rate of frame shifting everywhere, and that depends on that yes. type of phenomenon. But these particular sites have been selected to be frame shifted, and it is more than just the current usage. So I'm not.
Yeah. So the frame shift presumably has some function in this gene, and they know so they knew about this before they started.
It's not just enough to just put a red column to use a frame shift at that level. There's more than
that. You're just going to compare what happens when you put a different.
You're just going to compare one codon just before the point at which the frame shift occurs, right? So and we're presuming that doesn't change the rate of the frame shift itself, but it changes the time that you're hanging about at that point, right? So the point is the frame shift has some random probability of occurring when you reach that point in the gene, and the longer you wait without doing anything, the more likely the frame shift is.
Okay,
on the other hand,
that this is going to be a linear relationship.
So basically, what they do is they vary the codon just before that point, and they see what fraction of the frame shift thing you get. And the more frame shift there is, the slower that codon was, right? So then, okay, so this allows you to conclude for all these orange amino acids that the C codon is faster, right? That's one piece of evidence. And also in the same experiment for the G, so this was the E. coli glutamine case where the G is preferred, right? And there was another measure, there's another different experiment where they actually measured rates. And I think this was for repeated codons. I think this was for something like a messenger RNA with many, many repeated codons of the same thing. And they concluded that for glutamic acid, the A codon is 3 times faster than the G. So, okay, so those are fairly simple old experiments that kind of tie in with what I'm talking about. Then you get to the more recent experiments where they make everything horribly complicated and they try to say what are the steps of translation. So, you know, the ribosome has to bind, this is the ternary complex with the tRNA and the GTP and the elongation factor, that has to bind. Then somehow or another, the ribosome has to tell whether this is the right tRNA. and it has to say, well, this fits properly, I'm going on to the next stage, and then I have to get rid of a GTP and do all sorts of things, right? So I would like to be able to put that kind of thing into a model for selection, but there's just too many parameters in there. And a question that we need to figure out is which of these steps is the step which distinguishes between different codons, right? So in those experiments, what they've done is they've compared cognate codons and near cognate codons, right? So a near cognate codon would be a tRNA for a wrong amino acid, but it differs by 1 out of 3. So they can show the differences in the probabilities of all those steps, for example, for a right tRNA and a slightly wrong tRNA. But what they haven't really done is looked at differences between two different codons for the same tRNA. So I'm interested in differences between two correct tRNAs, okay, or two correct codons with the same tRNA. And those numbers haven't really been measured at this level of detail. Okay, so then you get to this big thing about accuracy. So this is what the referees of my paper keep trying to make me say. So clearly you can have some selection for accuracy rather than speed. So supposing that the reason a codon is preferred is because this is more accurately translated, and it's less, in other words, it's less likely for a wrong tRNA to come into this codon than the other one. Now, what people like Klaus Wilke say, for example, is that the reason accuracy is important is because if you make a wrongly translated protein, that is more likely to misfold, and a misfolded protein might be toxic to the cell. So they will say that there's some small probability that a protein is misfolded for every time you make it. And if you use the wrong codons, you're more likely to make a wrong amino acid go in there, because it's less accurately translated, and you're more likely to lead to a misfolded protein, and so there's selection for translational accuracy. And that argument might explain, for example, why highly biased genes are under stronger, it might explain why highly expressed genes are under stronger selection. Because if you just say that there's some small probability of wrongly folded proteins, then you're making this protein thousands of times, so there's thousands of times more wrong ones as well. So if the selective effect is the toxicity of a misfolded protein, then you would expect that to be strongest in the highly expressed genes as well. So it might explain differences between low and high expression genes. But it doesn't, to my mind, explain differences between organisms as a function of the rate of replication. So I still think that the speed must be important in bacteria, which are rapidly multiplying, because there's this strong relationship with growth rate. Okay, maybe in other organisms like Drosophila or humans, where codon bias, people have argued about codon bias in eukaryotes, and it's much less clear than it is in bacteria. Right. And so maybe things like accuracy are more important in those big, slowly evolving organisms.
But maybe, I mean, you are talking about these solid protein as toxic, which is not necessarily the case, but they are going to be degraded. That's at some point, they are not functional anyway.
Yeah.
So even if you don't think in terms of toxicity, but in terms of correct translation accuracy, it's very costly to make a mistake, because then you have to finish the protein. So one mistake, you waste complete translation.
Yeah. If you make a non-functional protein, you've wasted something. Yeah, so that's true. Yeah, there's an energetic cost.
It might be much more costly than just. I mean, at some point in the trade-off, but slowing down translation to increase accuracy might actually increase overall the rate of correct translation speed.
Yes, okay. So the people that argue for accuracy are usually arguing that the toxicity effect is more important than the energetic cost, but I agree that there might be an energetic cost. And for these species at least, I'm arguing that neither of those is as important as the speed, in fact. Because otherwise we wouldn't be able to explain the clear relationship with the growth rate. But I think that accuracy is also important. And so what I want to get to the bottom of now is, how do we measure both things in the same data?
Is it also the case in these bacteria
I noticed in Drosophila, where, and this maybe argues against accuracy, and that is the longer a protein is, the less codon bias it inevitably has. So if it's just pure selection for
I'm still confused about that, because that goes in different directions in different species.
Well, like in Drosophila, it goes that way, but I don't know.
It's lower bias in longer genes.
Yeah.
And I think there are some, I think there's E. coli where it's higher bias in longer genes.
It's higher.
Yeah, I there are some papers about that, which, and it's confusing.
Okay, yeah, I don't know that.
But maybe the longer genes are translated at lower efficiency. Maybe small, rather than the genes, they are small, very small, in Chinese, they are probably everywhere. So maybe they are small because they've been selected to be translated in the past. So maybe there's a correlation.
That could be, but still, if you look at some long genes that are highly expressed, or said to be highly expressed, still in Drosophila, they just really lose their codon bias in a very regular way. But in Drosophila, one of the explanations for that has to do, and this would be interesting to talk about just the general context of what you're finding, having to do with background selection, or this Hill-Robertson effect that we mm-hmm. talked about mm-hmm. before, which may be
it would be interesting to say what does link. Yes, because this is a one codon theory. This is a one mutation theory. That thing I started off with is just it comes from the fixation probability of a mutation with a positive or negative effect. That's a single thing. So you're right. It doesn't include linked selection.
But if you think in terms of this kind of scheme and of accuracy. So I'm not familiar with the very detail of the small individual steps of translation at the codon recognition step, but I presume that it's got K on, and then there's the K off, and probably the specificity is dictated by the K off, right? So usually what happens is that you have a kind of residency of your substrate in enzyme, mm-hmm. and then what's a so-called perfect enzyme is going to actually make the reaction 100 times the substrate binds. Mm-hmm. But then usually this is low in terms of specificity. But if you want to increase specificity, you have to is it a trade-off again? You have to accept that you have to these sections.
No, you're right. Yes.
So then.
So this could go backwards and forwards several times before it's accepted to the next phase.
Yeah. So usually the K on is the diffusion rate.
Yes.
Can assume. Mm-hmm. And so what you are measuring is actually the K off. Okay. So what you are looking is that if you prefer the GC over the GU, it means that you have a strong selection for having a high at that stage for
the, stronger. Yeah. So that's so, the kind of thing they're trying to understand with this.
So no, I mean that it's not so different. I mean the.
They make it very. You read these papers and they make it extremely complicated because they divide these into very many different states, and they have many different parameters, some of which depend on the codons and some of which don't. And.
But I mean that what I mean is that maybe this problem of maybe you are not looking at translation efficiency but rather specificity is almost a semantic problem, because actually you are probably looking at a step which is really optimized between efficiency and accuracy, but this is really the same phenomenon in terms of molecular events. It's exactly the same step you're looking at, and so I mean this is a false argument. So maybe you are not looking at efficiency but accuracy. They are the same thing, because you are probably looking at exactly the same step.
It's the same step, but the cause of the selection is different. I mean, the logical argument is different. And what should we tune these parameters to be? It would be different according to what the selection is. Anyway, this is the last one before the break. And this is answering the question of Eric about what happens if you look at expression levels. So in yeast, Akashi had already binned the genes in yeast according to expression level. And they were binned so that approximately equal numbers of genes were in each bin. And then this is the average of the expression level measured in the messenger RNA for each bin. And this is the codon frequency. So now I just want to use this to test the assumption that the strength of selection is proportional to the expression level. So if I just say the selection is proportional to the expression level, it should lie on one of these exponential curves, and one parameter k determines the steepness of the curve, and more or less it works. Okay. And the point is that there's a whole load of points down here because there are really very many genes which have low expression levels, okay? So there are very many points here which are essentially negligible on this scale, and there's big gaps between the points out here because there are really only a small number of genes which have high expression level. So this is kind of why I was assuming there were just two cases. It's like saying the average of everything else is some big point down here, and then there's the few in the top level. And that I can do that without having to measure the expression level.
I have a question. If you could try to make this kind of plot for Agrobacterium, for instance, where the bias is very, very low, much lower, let's say, than what's happening in yeast, which is fantastic, in fact. So what sort of plot do you have?
Well, I don't know because I haven't. I don't. Is there expression level data for Agrobacterium?
Yeah, probably you find something, but certainly if it's not Agrobacterium, you can find other microbes for which some data are available. What you could do is to try to take subsets, eventually, of the full set of genes and see what's happening, which are important for metabolism on this particular microbe, and see what's happening. Because in yeast, it's fantastic. It's a very nice, fact. But yeast is very, very biased. The signal there, it's the best that we can actually find. But if you try to say something about the whole population of microbes, and then it seems to me another story.
That's what my diagram is supposed to show, that there are quite a lot of bacteria with very strong selection, and there are quite a lot which don't, and so codon usage in those organisms would be a mutational property, that kind of thing, right? I don't think there's a conflict there. Okay, that's the break, commercial break. So this is just an advert for mitochondrial genomes, right? We have a lot of data on mitochondrial genomes, and we've been building a database of it. And you can do nice things like select different groups of species. So I've clicked on arthropods, and then I can sub-click and get all the crustacea and download whatever genes I want for whichever group of species. And of course, once you've arranged that information, you can do different things with it. So I'm interested in downloading the sequences, obviously. I'm interested in the codon usage. I'm interested in looking at what the genomes are. this is just a picture. So here we have an alligator and a bird, right? What's happened to the gene order between alligators and birds? You've got the same genes in slightly different order. There's been one red and yellow tRNA have been switched there. And this blue block has been moved over here, right? So not much has happened in vertebrates, in fact. So the human gene order is the same as hagfish, which go right back to the base of the vertebrates. Most vertebrates are the same, but there's one little change. This is Drosophila versus thrips. This is two insects. And in fact, Drosophila is very similar to other groups of arthropods. Things like Limulus, which is the horseshoe crab, one of the first diverging arthropods. So we know Drosophila gene order is pretty close to ancestral. And this one is only found in one species, and it's just completely different from everything else. So this says numbers of breakpoints 30. So in other words, to get from this order to this order, I have to chop it in 30 places and stitch it back together again in different. So for some reason, in some species, gene order goes haywire. Anyway, that's kind of data sitting to be analyzed. I've got large numbers of cases of gene orders in different orders, and if anybody's interested in trying to understand what the mechanisms are for switching orders of genes, then I'd be interested in that. It's been on my things to do list for a long time. So, so codon usage in, this is the human mitochondrial genome, this is what it looks like, and I'm going to focus on the fourfold degenerate sites in this case. And the question is, and so clearly if I look at one group, they're not all equal frequency, right? And is it mutation or selection? That's the same question as before. So, let me say why I think mutation is important in mitochondria. Here I'm just looking at the fourfold degenerate sites. So that's the third positions in the green boxes, right? And I'm plotting on this curve, this is U. So this is the frequency of U at fourfold degenerate sites. This is the frequency at U at first position and at second position, right? And basically they're straight lines. So in each case, the first and second position plots are linear as a function of the fourfold degenerate site frequency. And they vary enormously. So this is going from 10 to 40. So and these are fish, I believe. Does it say fish? Yes. So each dot is one species of fish. So within fish, the mutation, the average frequency of U goes from 10 to 40%. So really all species are not the same in terms of their mutational properties. And I'll suppose that this is basically governed by mutation, and that this is governed by mutation and selection on synonymous substitutions now. So this is selection on amino acid substitutions. And the one curve is always steeper than the two curve, right? So the thing we notice from this is that the first position substitutions vary noticeably as the fourfold degenerate sites vary. So we can see that first position substitutions happen, and they're driven by mutation, okay? And so the size of the slope here is telling me something about the strength of stabilizing selection on amino acid substitutions. The stronger that selection is, the flatter the slope will be, and second position substitutions seem to be under stronger selection than first position substitutions. That's what it's telling us there, right? So now we know why that is. So this is my favorite diagram that has to come out in every talk, right? So this is a plot of physical properties of amino acids. So what we did was we took 8 examples of physical properties like hydrophobicity, size, shape of the side chain, a measure of electric field around the side chain, and isoelectric point, all these things. So we took 8 physical properties that had been measured by biochemists, and then we did a kind of principal components plot of this. So really, what this shows you then is that amino acids are clustered quite strongly according to the column in which they appear in the genetic code. So all these are in the first column of the genetic code, right? And they're all at this end of the first component, which correlates with hydrophobicity. So these are all hydrophobic amino acids, and they're on the large side because this second component correlates with size. So these are kind of biggish hydrophobic amino acids, and they're all pretty similar, and they all have in the first column of the genetic code, so they have the same second position but different first positions in the colon, right? And the second position ones are also pretty well correlated. Most of the third position ones are, so the third position ones are the hydrophobic ones, the hydrophilic ones, right? It's a bit less though, because there are some outliers in the third position. In the third column. The third column is the one with the A at the middle position, right? And then the fourth column, they're just all over the place. So in the fourth column, we've got arginine and tryptophan and cysteine. They're just completely different. So the reason then that we get... So I want to explain why do we see greater variability at first position than second position. It's because when we make a first position substitution, we go to another amino acid with a similar property, right? So we go from isoleucine to leucine to valine or whatever in a cluster here or a cluster there, and when we make a second position substitution, we go from one cluster to another, which is a bigger change and is less likely to occur, okay? And we went further than this, and we tried to explain, well, which amino acids would change. So the point is that, so now this is, there's T4. This is the frequency of the T at the four-fold degenerate sites. And I'm just saying, well, it's serine happens to go up with that one, threonine happens to go down, and alanine happens to not do anything. And we were trying to understand the directions of those things. But and that's published a while back, so I'm not going to say any more about that. But that was kind of in my head when we started to look at the codon usage in the mitochondria, because it's clear that it's clear that mutation varies a lot between species, and it's sufficiently strong to divide to drive non-synonymous substitutions as well as synonymous ones. So we might expect it to dominate synonymous ones, right? That was kind of a first thing in my head. So now we say that mutation gets more and more complicated, because it's not just a single point effect. It's correlated, right? So it depends on which bases are either side. So this is the frequency of U at fourfold degenerate sites. Each dot is one species, right? And this is the frequency of U following a given base. So if we take this black square, this is a U at a fourfold degenerate site following a U at second position. And you see that the black thing is always larger than this. This line is the one-to-one line, right? And so there's always more U following a U at second position than there is than average, right? And this is a U following a G. Okay, the plus is a U following a G. So if the G at the second position, there's always less U. So this says that even though between species, the average amount of U varies enormously, there's some consistent context-dependent effect, which is always in one direction. So there's always more U following a U. However much U there's always more U following a U, right? So that tells me that mutation must be not just a single site effect. And then we can measure frequency ratios. I mean, this is just which dinucleotides are most frequent. And the two, three means that we're talking at a second position followed by a third position, and the third position is a four-fold degenerate site. And the 3-1 means we're looking at a third position synonymous site followed by a first position, right? And, well, okay, so the most frequent is GG and the least frequent is CG, and I don't know why. And people always come out with this thing about CPG islands and so on, right, which has got something to do with methylation of the bases. And as far as we know, methylation of the bases doesn't happen in mitochondrial genomes. So the explanation probably isn't the same as the one that you see in the literature for CPG islands. But all I want to say now is then that there are strong context-dependent effects on the mutation. And now mutation gets more complicated again, because it depends on which strand you're on. So this is the replication of the mitochondrial genome. So it starts at one place. OH there is origin of replication of the heavy strand. So it's going to start at one place there, and it's going to go around in one direction. So by the time we get to here, this strand has been single-stranded for a long time, but this strand has had its other partner duplicated as we went along, right? So as this goes along, the other strand is being synthesized, but the other one stays single-stranded for a long time till we get round to this point, which is origin of replication of the light strand, and then that goes the opposite way, okay? So now, the argument is that a lot of mutations happen whilst the strand is single-stranded. So and depending on where the gene is, which strand it's on, and where it is relative to the origin of replication, there will be a different mutational environment experienced. And so this ranking order is called DSSH. It's it's a measure of how long a gene spends in the single-stranded state. Okay. So this has been observed by several people previously, right? So this is the ranking according to what we would expect from the positions of the genes on the genome. And then it's worth saying that there's one, so this is in vertebrate mitochondrial genomes. There's 12 in the same order in all the vertebrate mitochondrial genomes, or at least in the mammals and the fish that we're going to look at. And then the ND6 gene is the one gene on the opposite strand. So now let's... So this is just the frequency of U at fourfold degenerate sites, averaged over mammals, and this is this 1, 2, 3 is the ranking order of the genes in the order that they were on the previous slide, right? So basically this is saying that if I go, there's 12 genes on one strand, and there's a systematic variation in the frequency of the bases as I go along one strand, and the one gene on the other strand is just way out of line. So there's a big, big difference between the two strands. Okay. So, given that all that is happening, is it possible to detect translational selection? That's the question. And the thing about the mitochondria is there's only one tRNA for each of those green boxes, right? So the code has been simplified such that one tRNA will do, and it's always the one with the wobble U. So we said, way back we had this curve that says in bacteria there's sometimes three different tRNAs for a four codon family, but in mitochondria these have been deleted and there's only this one left. So we know that this one has to pair with all of them. It may nevertheless be that there's a preference because that U pairs better with some things than another. So that's possible. We start off with an assumption, though, that that's probably a weak effect, because we know that if we look at the bacteria, it's only in those slowly growing organisms with weak selection where we reduce to one gene anyway, right? There are just a few cases of where there's a one U for a four codon box in bacteria, and those are in things like Wolbachia and probably Buchner and things like that, where those are halfway on the line to be mitochondria anyway, right? Those have been slimmed down, and those are ones where we don't see much translational selection. So what I'm saying is the existence of a single tRNA for a four codon family seems to go in bacteria with cases where there's weak selection. So we might say there's weak selection in mitochondria as well. Now, what if there were selection coming from this U? It's going to be quite difficult to detect it because all boxes have the same single gene, right? So let's suppose that U preferred A for some reason, right? Then it would prefer A in every four codon box, and if there was an effect going on, it would give the same effect in all those boxes, so we wouldn't see it. That's the problem, right? On the other hand, we might be able to detect for accuracy. So the test for accuracy is that you compare codon usage in high and low. You compare codon usage in conserved and variable sites, right? So the argument says that if you have a site which is conserved over evolution between species, then it's probably really important that you get this site right. And so if the accuracy of translation is important, then it's going to be particularly important at sites which have a conserved amino acid. So then if you observe a difference in codon usage between the conserved and variable sites, then you conclude this comes from within one gene. So this is a difference between different sites in one gene. Then you conclude that that's due to accuracy. And there's a number of papers which have shown that's true. So we could see that in mitochondrial sequences if it occurred, right? What we can't do is what I did with bacteria, because in bacteria it depended on knowing high and low expression genes. And in mitochondria, presumably they're all high expression. I mean, there's only a few genes left in mitochondria, and they're presumably being translated a lot, and they're all essential, and presumably they're all being translated more or less at the same amount, because those are things that occur in the complexes in the mitochondrial membrane, right? And you basically need a one-to-one ratio of all those proteins in the complexes. So the whole basis of what I did with bacteria doesn't work for mitochondria, right? Okay, so now we look again at the codon table for humans, and we say which is the preferred codon, right? So the red blob is the preferred codon, and it's not always the same one. So here's the A is preferred, and here the C is preferred, right? So the first thing we might say is, let's suppose it was just a simple model of mutation, a one-site model of mutation. There would be equilibrium frequencies of the four bases. And if that were the only thing going on, then you would have the same frequencies in each box, right? But this is clearly not true. So this suggests the importance of the previous, of the middle base. So I already showed by looking at the dinucleotides that the middle base was important. And this would suggest that the middle base is influencing, say, why the A codon is preferred here and the C codon is preferred there. Okay? So what I see from that is that probably this is a context-dependent mutation effect, right? Can't be a single-site mutation effect. It can be a context-dependent mutation effect. Can't really be a tRNA effect because the tRNAs are the same for every box, right? There's, in every box, there's one tRNA with a wobble U. So if there was an effect, it would be the same effect, and it wouldn't explain the difference between the boxes, right? Yep. So let's just do some quick statistical tests. This is a test to say whether the frequency of the base at the fourfold degenerate site, which is N here, depends on the base at the second position, which is, and there's three groups here because they correspond to U, C, and G at the second position, and there aren't any fourfold degenerate boxes with A's, right? So I'm adding up these ones, those ones, and those ones, and then I've got three tables of four, and I'm asking whether those are statistically different from one another, and they are. So I did this with 214 species of fish. I classified them as not significant if P is greater than 5%, significant if it's less than 5%, and highly significant if it's less than 0.001. And so there should be, there should be 0.001 times 214 species in the highly significant category, which is 0.2 species, whereas in fact every species I look at is in the highly significant category, right? So that says that in every species you look at, there's a strong effect of the middle base. So now I want to say, we know that the middle base has an effect. Let's look at other things. Let's look at these four boxes here, because they have a C at the middle base. Is there anything, any difference between these four groups of four? And there is, right? Because I've still got 81 species out of 214 with a highly significant thing. And I've only got 58 insignificant ones, and I should have 203, right? I should have 95% of 214, right? So there's still a fairly strong effect which causing differences between those four codon families. And, well, what is it, right? So then we try to get some likelihood models of this. So on this thing, Z is the base at the fourfold degenerate site, and N of Z is the observed numbers of codons with a Z at the fourfold degenerate site, and it depends on these four factors, right? So the factor is, so the A factor is some factor that causes differences between different groups of different families of four, and I'm presuming it might arise from some differences in tRNAs that we don't understand. So if tRNAs were causing some selection, which for some reason were not the same in those four boxes, that would lead to different codon usage in the four boxes, right? Now I've got this B factor, which is translational accuracy, and I can test for that by comparing conserved and variable sites. So I can divide sites into two groups according to whether they're conserved, like I look at all mammals, and then I look at a site which is the same amino acid in all mammals, and I look at other sites where the same amino acid appears, but it's aligned with different amino acids, right? So that's the B effect. The D effect is this DSSH thing for the amount of time it spends single-stranded. So I divided genes into two groups, which were at the beginning and at the end of that list of the ranking order that we had a few slides back. And then the X is the context-dependent effect of the following first position. Okay, so we've controlled for the second position because I'm looking at these four amino acids, right? So we've controlled for the second position. But some other first position base comes after that. Now, the thing about the first position base is that it might have an equally strong effect as the second position base. I mean, if mutation properties shouldn't depend on the frame, right? But even if the first position has a strong effect, it somehow averages out, because any base can appear after a codon. So this U can be followed by anything. Whereas if I'm looking at a threonine codon, this U is always following the C. So the effect of the C is in the same direction every time I look at a threonine codon, but the effect of the first position is different for each codon, right? So if they were completely random sequences, then the first position wouldn't have an effect, right? But sequences aren't random, we have real sequences. So what we do then is we just count in the real sequences how many times is a U in a threonine codon followed by each of the other things, right? And that's the X factor in this. Okay. So now I have a model, which I'm not going to explain, which predicts the frequency of the fourth position as a function of these four things. And so the log likelihood of seeing my data is this thing. And this is the most complicated model, right? This is the model that assumes that it depends on all four factors. But I could have simpler models which only depend on 3, 2, 1 or 0 factors, right? The 0 factor model would be just say there are four frequencies of four bases and they don't depend on any of those things. So the 0 model would have 3 parameters because the fourth one adds up to 1. So there'd be 3 independent parameters in the 0 model. And for each factor I have to add more parameters. And then we come up with this question of model selection, which we talked about a long, long while ago. And if anybody still remembers what we did about 2 months ago, we talked about how do you select between alternative models with different numbers of parameters. And the method I've used in several different papers, in fact, is this AIC method. So AIC is Akiki's information criterion. And what it says is that you should choose the model for which this thing is smallest. So small values of AIC correspond to high likelihood, but they're penalized by the number of parameters. So it's saying you should pick a model which is sufficiently complicated to explain the trends in the data, but not one which has too many parameters, okay? Say it again.
Should it be a parameter in front of a number of parameters?
No, it's a 1. The point is there is an argument why it's a 1, right?
So why?
Well, okay, then I give you my very long statistics book and I get you to explain the big hard chapter in the middle of that book which comes out with this formula, right?
So Chris Wiggins talked about that and he said he couldn't understand.
He could or he
could not.
And yeah, so the question is,
performed quite badly.
So you remember I put on the on that day I put a thing on the wiki which advertised this book by Burnham and Anderson, which is it's a whole book talking about how you do this kind of model selection.
You think that from a physics point of view, so if log L is something like an energy, then there would be this number of parameters, and then there should be some kind of how much weigh model complexity versus optimization?
Well, I just somehow remember seeing this sort of expression again and again and again and again over years, and under different names, and I'm just trying to remember whether some versions of this argument have a temperature in there, and
I don't think so.
So it's always, so this is a sort of universal thing.
Okay, so I would be happy if I understood the definition of this better, and if you want to talk about it, I'd be pleased to talk about it. But I mean, this is a well-established way of doing it. There are other competing formulae, and I've used this one on test data, and I've used it on real data of several different types, and I'm happy that it gives a sensible answer, but if I knew why, I would be happier still. So this is delta AIC. So it's the improvement over the zero model, right? So the zero model, it says that there are just four frequencies and it doesn't depend on any of those factors. These are the one parameter models that it depends on one factor only. Two factor models, and then I have not included 3 and 4 factor models because they're always bad, in fact. They're always overfit. So if we just look at humans, Okay, so the best one is this factor X. So factor X is the following first position base, and this leads to a large improvement, okay? And so this is the best model for humans. I also looked at the averages. It's a bit strange to do, I wanted to somehow summarize the data. So if I just summarize the average of the data AIC, this is also the model for which there's the lowest average, so the factor X being the most important. This is the number of species for which delta AIC is greater than naught. So I took 40. So I had hundreds of species in my original data set, right? But I want to now look at independent ones, and because I want to hopefully consider species which are sufficiently far apart so that synonymous substitutions have been randomized, right? So I took one from each order of mammals and each order of fish, and that gave me 40. So these are numbers out of 40. So there were 38 out of 40 cases where this factor X gave me an improvement, right? And the other models sometimes gave me an improvement, right? And then I've got how many species for which this model is the best of the naught or the single factor models, right? So in other words, if I'm only going to have a single factor, I should pick factor X. How many species is this the best of all models? Well, quite often the single factor X is the best of all models, but sometimes a factor, like this one is A and X and this one is D and X, so sometimes X plus another factor is the best model. And this is the number of times for which factor X is included in the best model, either on its own or with something else. Okay, so the point is, factor X is the most important by whichever way you count this. And the thing which is the other thing that stands out is that the B factor is not important. So the B factor is the B factor is the translational selection between conserved and variable sites. It's the translational accuracy, right? So the translational accuracy that we can test for doesn't show up. The thing that now I don't understand is really this A keeps cropping. So the second most important factor is the A, and the A was the thing that said it depended. So we've taken factor X now. Factor X is the thing, is the base after that, and that has a big effect. We've controlled for the first position base, and even so, there's some effect of factor A, which is that these four boxes are just not the same. So now I don't know why. And well, I mean, I don't know why, but it could be because those tRNAs are exerting an effect which is not the same in all the boxes. But then you'd have to explain why the tRNA effect was not simply dependent on the U base, right?
But why would it be, so years of teasing apart these different mutational effects.
Yeah.
But why is that, why is it obvious that this is more important than assuming that the tRNA binding to the codon depends on more than the last base? So you could also make, you know, context-dependent models of, or like multi-base models of the codon binding.
Yes, you could.
So why is it clear that this wouldn't have a bigger effect than the context-dependent mutations?
So let's draw a codon. Let's draw a serine codon, which is UCA, for example. This is the third position.
Right.
And let's draw a anticodon, which has to be going the opposite way, and it has to be UGA then. Okay, so these pair, and this one is the wobble position. So this A could be A or anything, GC. This A is the third position, it could be anything. And the wobble position is always a U, right?
As soon as the G might sort of push the U away a bit more than C at that position, right?
Yes, it might, but now the point is that it's the same. This situation, now let's look at serine, right? So now we look at, so not serine, I mean proline, let's look at proline, right? Now proline is C, it's the same, CGU, CCA, it's exactly the same second base and first base. So if this U affects the A, what you just said, I think, was that this U might like the A better than this G here, right? But now the same thing is occurring here. And the second position is also the same. So if it's something to do with stacking of bases here, it's also the same.
Right.
The only thing that's different is the first position.
First position, yeah.
Yeah. Or maybe I don't know what comes after. So maybe the one here is different. I don't know.
So there may be trinucleotide effects. I mean, why stop at dinucleotide?
Just, you know, trinucleotide mutation effects.
Yeah.
Possibly.
You go through the exercise, you also find very tracking frequency. I understand that. Maybe it's a
tissue. Yeah.
Context dependency.
Yeah. So, well, okay, so that's about that. Okay. I think that might be. Okay, so that's really the end, but I thought you might just want to see one or two very small things.
There's also this interesting observation that when you, because you found a large effect of that one position,
yeah,
over the very next base, and if you actually look at the representation of those dinucleotides, 3-1, all the possible combinations, They actually have the sort of a similar it's not random. Certain first positions tend to occur more often after a particular third position.
Mm-hmm.
So some are relatively overrepresented and some are relatively underrepresented.
Yes.
And if you look at that over and underrepresentation of those, they tend to be similar. Go along in the same direction as the same overrepresentation of the codons' usage themselves. It seems to be some correspondence.
Yes, I think, isn't that more or less what I had in this table here? This was this table. So this was the dinucleotide preference from a 2-3 position,
right,
and a 3-1 position, and they are fairly similar.
Right. There's definitely some overlap. It's just interesting.
Yeah.
Perhaps the mutation process has been molded in a way to, mimic kind of amino acids, or the other way around. There's some connection between the mutation context of the mutation process and actual codon.
Okay, I want to finish, and I got something fun to finish with. So, does anybody know what that species is? What?
Cucumber.
Well, bearing in mind what day it is, right? So, okay. And then also, bearing in mind what day it is, I thought there might be some spooky human genetics effects. So. This was a person who claimed to be a witch and was asking whether being a witch was inherited, and she said that it wasn't, even though both her grandmother and her mother were. On the other hand, wizards are inherited, apparently. So, according to the British Medical Journal, right? But being a wizard is inherited. And then it turned out that there really are Halloween genes in Drosophila, and I'm not quite sure what they do, but here's a phylogeny of them, and they're called spooks and spookiest and phantom and disembodied. And do you know what they are, Halloween genes? No? Okay, well, that's enough. Thank you.